Okay, makes sense. Number seven.
Don't be afraid to go to all your competitors who you know aren't doing well and propose to them a consolidation where you take over their assets, meaning their customers and prospects, and you give them a perpetual share of the business or the profit that come for those forever. There are tons of people in this kind of a very competitive and a very difficult environment who are just eking out a living. They're barely making a salary, but their choices are to go out of business, to go bankrupt, or to try to get a job, which they aren't gainfully employable. But they're so shackled with overhead of rent, of staff, of equipment, of leases, that they can hardly pay themselves a salary, and many of them don't. But if you were to go to them and show them how, by consolidating their customers, by putting them through your enterprise, using your fixed overhead, your people, your staff, your equipment, the revenue from their customers that wasn't making them a dime could be so profitable that you could give them in their pocket 25% of the profits or the sales, you'd make more money because incrementally it would just be found money for you. They'd make more money because they could get rid of their overhead, get rid of their office, get rid of their equipment, even if they had to sublease, and make more money for doing nothing than they did for working their hearts out. And if they keep doing what they're doing now, they'll probably trend into oblivion or into insolvency, whereas if they consolidate with you, they can become your PR officer, your goodwill ambassador, and make more money for doing nothing than they're making for working their heart out 10 and 12 hours a day.
It sounds like you've seen this happen.
I do it all the time for people.
Okay, number nine.
Number nine is evaluating all the activities in your business that you have already committed to, that are in motion, where you have velocity going and improving upon them. Things you're already doing and you've committed to do now, whether it's sending mailings, whether it's putting people on the selling floor, on the phones, in the field, making telephone calls, doing any kind of trade shows, and asking yourself how many better ways you can get leverage on it. In other words, whatever you're doing now, finding ways to get the effort to produce more yield, more customers, higher unit of sale, because that's something you're doing, whether you do it right or wrong, you're already committed to doing it. It costs no more to produce a greater yield. It costs no more to get more customers. It costs no more to change headlines. It costs no more to improve upon things. All it does is produce greater current and residual benefit.
All right, number 10 for today.
Number 10 is to use experts, but in a result-based capacity. There are tons of people who are experts who have never, ever helped their clients realize how to benefit from their expertise. They just sell fee-based or project-based services, and they basically, there's an old adage, they ask to borrow a client's watch or clock, and then they charge them for watching it. But there are a lot of experts that really have incredible capacity. If you can start regularly interviewing experts and throwing a gauntlet or a proposition to them, whereas you'll allow them to apply their expertise to your business, but won't pay them a fee, won't pay them by the hours, but will pay them a very generous share of the improved blank, profit, sales, efficiency, productivity that they render, you can have all kinds of experts working on your business to improve it strictly on a performance basis, and you shouldn't mind sharing them with them 10, 25, 40% of the improvement because it's all found money. But this way you can get tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of expertise only working for you in a results-based capacity on a performance basis, where you can have everybody basically breaking their butts to find greater ways for your business to operate, for your business to sell, for your business to be managed, for your business to be organized, for your business to advertise, market, sell, promote, and you never pay a dime unless you measurably know it produces a greater outcome for you.
Okay. All right. Jay, three-minute summary recap. How about you just talk about getting us out of the desiring stage into the action mode. I think that, in a way, is one of the most significant things you do.
Well, I think that the best tool or mechanism or secret or strategy that I have found to do that is to acknowledge what you are allowing yourself to miss out on. In other words, let's say today you get up at 6 in the morning, you take a shower, you get to work at 8, you open the door, you do whatever you're going to do that day. You've got whatever amount of people working for you doing whatever they're going to do. You've got whatever number of customers that you have created doing whatever they're going to do, buying from you, not buying from you, writing to you, visiting you, being visited. If you know every day that what you have contented yourself with as a result is a third or a tenth or a half or a fraction of what you should be getting out of yourself, out of the day, out of the people, out of the customers, out of the effort, out of the investment, out of the inventory, out of the location, out of the relationship, then you might start getting emotionally, maybe not angry enough, but impassioned enough to not allow yourself to satisfy or settle for so little again. You need to get, as Tony Robbins would say, so much leverage on yourself that the pain of continuing to content yourself with mediocrity or subsistence result is worse than the pleasure of getting more richness out of each transaction or each day or each event or each activity or each person or each contact or each dollar. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense.
That's how I get people to do it.
Okay. How about just a few illustrations of how you get people to do that or how you have gotten people to do that?
Well, I do it in my training programs in a really neat way. People who've never tried more than one selling approach, I get 20 people who tried 19 other selling approaches to stand up and show how many of them have built their whole business on just one of them, any one of which is something that most people don't even know about or try. And then I show people, I say, well, let me ask you this. So you've learned 19 different ways to sell that you don't do, each one of which is singularly generating or driving or empowering a multimillion-dollar business. What you're saying to yourself is you've been content not to do any of those because you would rather be complacent and be satisfied with 1/20th of the yield, of the success, of the profit, of the income, of the results you're able to give because you want to stay myopic. So you're saying to yourself you don't want 19 times that, or more like probably 100 times that, because by incorporating those, you pulled together the laws of exponentiality, and the outcome is going to be geometrically that. You don't want a bigger house for the same or less effort. You don't want to drive a brand-new car. You don't want to be able to retire 10 years early. You don't want to have all your salespeople be richer and have their families be more comfortable. You don't want all your kids to have the education they can. You don't want to be able to spend 4 or 5 months a year traveling with your wife or husband. Is that right, Marty?
Okay. Jay, thanks for your thoughts today. A lot of material I want to apply.
Okay. Thank you, Marty. I'll talk to you next time we talk.
Talking with the marketing genius, the wizard, Jay Abraham on The Wizard's Edge. This is Marty Stacey. Look forward to talking to you next month. Welcome once again to The Wizard's Edge with marketing genius Jay Abraham. Jay, great to be talking to you again. What do you find most challenging in your personal life? You're an expert in many, many areas.
Well, I'll tell you, Marty, the biggest challenge I have for me is that I have one of the most fertile minds that you've probably ever experienced. I don't say that arrogantly or cocky. I just have a very fertile and a very expansive and a very liberated look at opportunities. I see opportunities everywhere. I see possibilities, and I'm very, very good at turning those into tangible results, but I don't have enough waking hours in the day. I want to help so many people. It's almost like the old commercial, I want to buy the world a Coke. I want to basically help everybody. I was in a very, very lengthy philosophical discussion last night with a really bright man, and we were talking about my challenge and my purpose, and I was saying it bothers me that people don't allow themselves a greater achievement from their life effort, and I feel like my purpose is to help them see what's possible. They know it's possible, and they know that the same or less effort could give them so much more now and in the future, and they opt not to do it. That's okay, but I really am troubled for people who don't know how much more is possible from the effort, the time, the investment, both in time and capital, human capital that they're spending. That's what really boggles me, because I want to help so many people, and I want to impact so many people, and I want to accomplish so many things, and I want to get so many concepts into play, and there's only 24 hours in a day.
Okay, well, if I figure out how to get more hours into the day, yeah, you'll be one of the first I tell. Talk a little bit about some of your marketing heroes.
Well, I think I talked in one of the sections about Albert Lasker, who was the man who created salesmanship in print. A man who worked for him for 20 years and probably singularly gave birth to more massive successes and enduring companies that are around today was a man named Claude Hopkins. I have studied Claude Hopkins' work probably, I've read it at least 50 times. It's made me at least $5 million, and every time I read it, it opens up vistas and horizons that are incomparable to me. It's the most wonderful work, very simple work. The man was a student of human nature and psychology back in an era in the 20s when you didn't have the benefit of high tech. You couldn't use beautiful women and high tech computer generated graphics. You had to make propositions work or not work on the quality and the integrity of their psychological understanding of the inner workings of the human being. And the man was a master, and the techniques and the insights and the laws and the principles and the concepts and methodology that he spawned back in the 20s are not only equally, they're probably more applicable today because people have shrouded and covered and steeped over all the base principles so much superfluous things that don't work that it's the few people who understand these principles are great. I happen to have a copy here in hopes that you would talk about my heroes. And there's a really neat introduction. It's about a page and a half that advertising great David Ogilvy wrote years and years ago about the man. And if I read that to you, it'll probably summarize pretty well, and it'll give you a quick two-minute dissertation on what the man was all about.
Yes, let's hear that.
So he wrote two books. One's called Scientific Advertising. It's all of about 80 pages, and it's about a one-hour read, and that book alone can make anybody probably double or triple whatever they're making now if they read it, if they believe it, if they apply even the most rudimentary of the techniques he teaches. Then there's a much more expansive book he wrote called My Life in Advertising, where he shares very openly and candidly and self-effacingly all the life experiences that he encountered, and he shares with you what he learned from each one and how he applied that to subsequent businesses, and it teaches you this concept of extrapolation. And it's a brilliantly candid and very integrated and eminently readable and very fast-paced book. It was written again in the 30s or so, but it's wonderful, and I think that somebody still publishes that one. But I'll read this because it's wonderful. It's very simple. It says, nobody at any level should be allowed to have anything to do with advertising until he has read this book seven times. Claude Hopkins wrote it in 1923. Rosser Reeves, who, by the way, Marty, is another master strategist who came up with the concept of unique selling proposition, bless him, gave it to me in 1938. Since then, I have given 379 copies to clients and colleagues.
Wow.
Every time I see a bad advertisement, I say to myself, the man who wrote this copy has never read Claude Hopkins. If you read this book of his, you will never write another bad advertisement and never approve one either. Don't be put off by Hopkins' staccato, graceless style. When he was a boy, he had to go to church five times every Sunday and knew most of the Bible by heart. This caused him to write with the brevity of the King James Version, but with none of its beauty. Don't be put off by his misuse of the word scientific, as Alfred Politz, he's a great researcher, pointed out. Hopkins does not indicate the boundaries between direct findings from experimentation and conclusions arrived to by general observation and reasoning. A few of the conclusions have been disproved by later research. For example, Dr. Gallup, who is the Gallup poll, and Dr. Starch, the Starch research, would not agree with Hopkins when he writes, in every ad, consider only new customers. People using your product are not going to read your ads. Nor would Procter & Gamble now agree that the most successful toothpaste advertisement never features tooth troubles in its headlines. Hopkins believed that nobody with a college education could write copy for the millions. Perhaps that was because he had not been to college himself. He thought that illustrations were a waste of space. Perhaps they were less important 50 years ago when magazines and newspapers were thinner and competition for the reader's attention less severe. But now this is the big part, Marty. But 42 years after Hopkins wrote this book, almost everybody would agree with the following conclusions. Number one, almost any question can be answered cheaply, quickly, and finally by a test campaign. And that's the way to answer them, not by arguments around a table. Number two, the only purpose of advertising is to make sales. It is profitable or unprofitable according to its actual sales results. Number three, ad writers abandon their parts. They forget they are salesmen and try to be performers. Instead of sales, they seek applause. Number four, don't try to be amusing. Money spending is a serious matter. Number five, whenever possible, we introduce a personality into our ads. By making a man famous, we make his product famous. Number six, it is not uncommon for a change in headlines to multiply returns from 5 to 10 times over. Number seven, some say, be very brief. People will read but little. Would you say that to a salesman? Brief ads are never keyed or traced. Every traced ad tells a complete story. The more you tell, the more you sell. Number seven, we try to give each advertiser a becoming style. He is given an individuality best suited to the people he addresses. To create the right individuality is a supreme accomplishment. Never weary of that part of the process. Number eight, platitudes and generalities roll off the human understanding like water from a duck. Actual figures, however, are not generally discounted. Specific facts, when stated, have their full weight and effect. Claude Hopkins was born in 1866. He died in 1932. At 17, he was a lay preacher, and his ambition was to become a clergyman. But he rebelled against his family's fundamentalist brand of religion and got a job as a bookkeeper for $4.50 a week. Not long afterwards, he joined the Bissell Sweeper Company and invented selling strategies which gave Bissell a virtual monopoly. This guy's hearing what he used to give companies virtual monopolies.
Mm-hmm.
Then into Swift & Company as advertising manager, then to Dr. Schutz Patent Medicine Company in Racine, where he persuaded his agency to let him write all the copy. Not only his own account, but for all kinds of the agency's accounts, including Montgomery Ward and Schlitz Beer. In 1908, when Hopkins was 41, he was hired by Albert Lasker to write copy for Lord & Thomas. Lasker paid him $185,000 a year, equivalent to $639,000 in today's money, and that was about 20 years ago or 30 years ago, so it's probably more like $2 million today. Hopkins earned every penny. He seldom stopped work before midnight and was prodigiously fertile. From his typewriter came campaigns which made a long list of products famous and profitable. They included Pepsodent and Palmolive. He was more than a copywriter in today's narrow sense of the word. He was a total advertising man. He invented ways to force distribution for new products. He invented test marketing. He invented sampling. He invented copy research. He invented brand, turning the page, images. He invented preempting the truth, and he wrote copy with sold merchandise. His unique effectiveness was due to three things. First, he loved his work. Second, he was a showman. Third, he was an unrelenting practitioner of the experimental method, forever testing new ideas in search of better results. He's just a wonderful man. I would encourage anybody who has any interest in making whatever they do produce 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 times better to get a hold of all his work.
Okay. All right. I assume not a lot of people do that.
No. It was published for a while by a company in Chicago, and I called them because I used to buy hundreds of the books and give them away. And I asked them how successful it was, and almost nobody bought them. I was one of their biggest customers. And it's sad because people think that only new high-tech breakthrough books are valuable. There's probably more greatness in studying the past than imaginable. I have, for example, in my collection, I have 300 tapes of great books that are out of print from the histories and the biographies of great, great, great achievers, including Bernard Baruch and the biography of Getty and all kinds of things. And most people think that the only people that know how to make money and know how to get advantage are people who live today. There are enduring, immutable laws and principles that may need to be updated because of an environment or understated because of competition, but they will endure as long as human beings exist. And from the time man was first placed on this earth to the time man is no longer here, human nature is human nature is human nature. When you understand these immutable principles, you gain such a distinctive and a negotiable and a universal and an enduring and a perpetual advantage in anything and everything you do with everybody in business and life and personal issues and causal issues. Yeah, anyhow, I mean, I'm very fervent about this, Marty.
Yes, I sense that this is a real important part of your thinking, and it sounds in some ways like it's pretty easy to find a copy of the book somewhere and really multiply your effectiveness.
You can. I mean, it's really great, and if they can't find one, they should call my office, because we reprinted, the original book is out of print. The My Life in Advertising, I think, is still in copyright, but we printed up one time, and we probably could arrange for a nominal amount to find it for anyone. But they can find it for good book finders. I originally found it by paying someone to find an old copy, but it has singularly had more impact on me than any other book I've ever read in my life, and I've read a lot of books. It has singularly made me more money. It has singularly molded and forged and redirected my entire attitude on interaction with people, on selling, on marketing, on persuasion, on demonstration in print and in other forms. And it's given me such, I mean, I can't even tell you the value it has had for me. And the funny thing is, it's a tiny little book. It takes an hour to read.
Okay, let's talk about one of your chief advertising strategies, or I shouldn't say advertising, marketing, concentric circles. What does that mean?
Concentric circles is a philosophy that says that the biggest payoff you can get from a selling relationship is not necessarily the first transaction. If you're more strategic than most, you will position people with the knowledge that there's so many subsequent, bigger, and continuous transactions of a higher level you can develop from that relationship if you base the initial sale on trust, on value, on service, on providing advantage to the other side. It's a philosophy that takes people who normally are content to make a modest profit, shows them how to make multiples of 10 times that profit over the life relationship with the customer. And it's a strategy that looks at the customer having value for you over the long haul much more substantially than the single transaction. It's a differentiation in the way you embrace your business. Most people look at business in the term of sales. I look at it in the term of enduring long-term perpetual customers. The best examples of concentric circles would probably be, I'll give you a couple of examples and I'll try to give you some reference examples that people would have experienced in their own life. I was very heavily involved years ago in the investment field, hard assets back in the 70s and 80s when inflation was rampant, gold, silver, precious metals, things like that. I studied the business and I saw that everybody in it was trying to basically slam dunk, double team, basically go to somebody, sell them a wad of gold or silver, you know, go on to somebody else, never deal with them again. And besides being unseemly and ethically unacceptable, it was a very short-sighted way to transact business because it limited and restricted tremendously the amount of business companies could get. I aligned myself with a company that was in a very embryonic stages. I forged for them a concentric circle-based philosophy. I got them to understand that human nature's inclination is the first time most people make a purchase, it's very rarely going to be anywhere close to the fullest, biggest purchase they have the capacity to make because they are skeptical, they are a little dubious-minded, they are apprehensive, they are uncertain, they aren't confident, they're not yet ready to make the fullest commitment.
Okay, stop right there, because I would guess that's a very useful principle for anyone listening to this tape. That's an aspect of human nature.
It's an immutable aspect. No, it is, absolutely. So instead of trying to go against the psychological or philosophical grain of humanity, go with it. Know that people don't really feel comfortable spending the full wad, and so approach them with on their side of the desk. And that's what I got these people to do. I got them to talk to people, prospective investors, and say, look, gold and silver is a very different kind of an investment than the traditional areas you've been interested in or are invested in. It's not intended on being an investment that goes up or down. Its purpose in your investment portfolio is a hedge. It's to counterbalance aberrations or crisis or chaos or cataclysmic events in the economy. And so you may or may not be comfortable with it. Consequently, we feel better if you buy less to start than more. If you are comfortable, as we think you will be, but we're not sure, we'll be only too happy to sell you more and progress you along. And that approach, Marty, was based on an understanding of concentric circles. The understanding was if somebody buys from you the first time, they are nowhere close to spending to their fullest capacity because they want to see how you will perform, how the product will perform, how they will feel comfortable with it, so they don't commit themselves 100% unless they're very promiscuous, and most human beings aren't. Consequently, rather than trying to go against the grain, I went with it. I got our salespeople to program that way. People loved that because it confirmed the whole philosophy that they subconsciously adhered to. They bought in droves, nominal amounts. Then we monitored them. We worked with them. We conferred with them over a period of time. And through a nurturous, consultative, advisory process, we started them out. On average, they'd buy $5,000 or $10,000, and we wanted them to buy gold first. If they were comfortable with that, we'd have them buy more gold. Then if they were comfortable with that, the next transaction would be silver. They're comfortable with that, they buy more silver. Then after they'd gotten into both of those investment forms and they were comfortable because those are base commodities and those are very safe and those are not as speculative, and if they go down, you can get out, and the premium that you pay for the transaction is a couple of percent. It's nominal. We then would inch them slowly into rare coins. First of all, starting them with what we call junk coins, which are coins that have a very low premium over gold precious metals content, so that if they're uncomfortable with them, they're safe. If they were comfortable with that, we'd get them into a little higher grade coin. We do it through sequences. The average customer that we dealt with bought from us about 8 times. The average customer our competitors dealt with bought 1 time. Our competitors tried to get an average sale of 15 grand. We were content with 5 or 10 initially, but our aggregate sale over the 8 transactions was probably, I'm going to guess, $100,000. Our competitors would make, let's call it 20%. If they were gold and silver, they would make roughly, on average, between gold and rare coins and everything, about 4%. But let's say that they average 10. They would probably make, on a $20,000 sale, $2,000. we would make on the aggregate more like $25,000 over the 8 transactions.
Okay.
We understood, at least I understood, and I imbued it in the culture of the company, that the real wealth comes from the continuous transactions. I'll give you another example. When I was in the rare coin business at its peak, there was tremendous interest, but there was also tremendous apprehension. I applied the theory and the concept and the laws of concentric circles to this equally as well. I surmise that there must be hundreds of thousands of people in the investment community who had an inherent interest and fascination and a desire to at least understand and examine the case for a rare coin investing at a deeper level, but they were very apprehensive about making a mistake and blowing a lot of money on either an investment form that wasn't right for them or categories of that investment form that weren't appropriate. So rather than trying to stuff $10,000 or $20,000 worth of the wrong rare coins down their throat, as most people were doing, I took the opposite tack. I said, okay, I understand concentric circles, and it's a progressive process. Consequently, I want to just get them into our pipeline in the most non-threatening and desirable way possible. So I ran ads, which I called marketing tests, where I offered 2 Morgan silver dollars. And Morgan silver dollars are standard silver dollars from a certain era, and they're very beautiful and they're very nice, for $19, which, by the way, was less than we paid for them wholesale, as part of an experimental test we were doing to see if rare coin investing was consistent with your temperament and your investment interest. And I included with it a $100 valued collection of reports, analysis, explanations, guidebooks, and interviews all about and with experts and economists and financial experts on rare coin investing and its role in today's investment environment. I interviewed hundreds of people, including famous economists who were down on rare coins, because I wanted to give people a balanced perspective so they could make a well-reasoned, honest decision. But my concept was very simple. I said to them, look, you can't really appreciate why everyone's excited about rare coins until you hold them, touch them, reflect on them, see the mystique that precious metal, silver, has on people. Look at the history that's embodied in your hands, the beauty, the artistry, because they are very beautiful. It may be right for you, it may not. The only way you can really know is not to go off buying $20,000 and making a mistake, but to start with 2 coins. Buy 2 coins and then see if it's right for you. If it is, then we would be only too happy to methodically and strategically and patiently work with you to determine the most intelligent portfolio strategy that would work with your interest and your investment and financial objectives. If it's not right for you, we don't want you to keep them. We want you to send them back to us, and we'll give you not the $19 you paid for them, but the $21 that we'd have to pay to buy them wholesale from our supplier to sell them to anyone else. The reason we want to give you 21 instead of 19 is that, so if it's not right, at least you can always say that the first time you invested in rare coins, you made a profit. And with that basis, we disarmed 100,000 people who bought a $19 trial set. We didn't make any money. We lost about $5 a transaction. So we started off with a loss of $500,000, which wasn't realized all at the same time. It happened over a year. However, of the 100,000 people, approximately 30,000 of them ended up buying a $5,000 initial starting portfolio. And we made about 20%. So we made 5,000 times 30,000. What is that, $15 million?
Okay.
What's 20% of that? $3 million? So we went from a $500,000 loss relatively immediately, in that year to a $2.5 million profit. Of the 30,000 people who bought 5,000, this is the concentric circle process, approximately 10,000 bought at least $10,000 or more. So that's another $10 million, isn't it?
All right.
At 20%, so there's $2 million more. Of those 10,000, approximately 1,000 bought an additional $50,000 or more. So that's another $5 million at 20% or $1 million profit. So do you see how the concentric circle philosophy works?
I do, especially with your example, which I guess why you gave it. How would that apply to me or someone who is not necessarily dealing with that large a ticket?
There are 2 different integrated ways that would apply. The first is an acknowledged attitude that unless you're an impulse tourist type of a business, you are in a business that has a high probability of interacting with that person on an ongoing basis. And you look at the person or the customer or the business as having the capacity to make multiple, numerous, and perpetual transactions with you. Or if you only sell one product or service, you look at the relationship as having the capacity to pay off multiple times for you if you get their trust and you can evolve to an advisory role where you can introduce them, you can direct them, you can offer them other products or services even if they're not the ones that you offer. So your strategic take on the relationship is it's not going to be a one-shot love them and leave them sale. It's going to be the beginning of a perpetual relationship that will endure forever, as close to forever as you can. And your goal will be to continually and progressively render them value and bring to them greater units of product or services that will improve or satisfy their life, their needs, their purpose. And if you take that kind of an attitude, the way you deal with them is much different than the way most people deal with transactions.
Can you talk about that just a little?
Well, the idea is, let's take a clothing store, for an example, all right?
All right.
If instead of saying, I'm going to sell this no-name person a shirt, and I'm going to sell some other no-name person a shirt, you took the attitude and said, I'm going to start a perpetual relationship with that person, Mr. J. Abraham. I may only sell him a shirt now, but I know that if I get his attention, if I get his respect, if I give him great advice, if I make him look great, if I only advise him on things that will do him service, and service may be make him look great or last long or whatever he's looking, for the result to be, I can guide him and direct him to want to come back and buy far more than just shirts for me or far more than just that one shirt. I can evolve him, if I direct him in his own best interest, to come back three times a year or four times and buy all his shirts and his pants and ultimately his suits and then his top coats and then bring his friends and the rest of his families. And the cumulative long-term benefit of me adopting a perpetual advisory role of building the relationship and progressing him to a higher level because I take care of him and I advise him and I benefit him and I give him the best advice on the best utilization of my product or service that will perform the greatest benefit to him, depending on what his or her benefit might be, that the cumulative result is instead of making a one-shot sale and never seeing him again and maybe selling him a $50 shirt that I own for $25 and making $25, I could turn that $25 initial starting transaction into $5,000 worth of clothing purchases a year for him and his family forever.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Now, I would guess a person starting out in business does not typically fully understand this. Some businesses do, and that's why they go on.
I think that in today's environment, most people don't realize a very critical distinction. The cost of acquiring a customer today is so expensive and so hard fought and hard won that you can't afford, just from an economic standpoint, to treat them like sales. They've got to be viewed as long-term customers, and I would suggest that everyone evolve in their mind a reference frame of considering them clients. Clients has a higher level of long-term relevance, of respect, of honor, and of importance. In Australia, they don't use the word customer. Everyone is a client, and they treat them with a higher reverence, a higher honor, a higher respect, a higher magnitude of relevance in their lives, and they see the relationship as being an ongoing one. And I think most people today don't see that positioning for their customers, but you've got to do it. And I would suggest everyone look at their customers as clients, because if you do, you'll treat them with more respect. And you look at the fact that whenever you start the relationship, it's only the beginning of a perpetual relationship. And your obligation, your purpose, your commitment, your charge, your intent, your strategy has got to be that my commitment is to take you to the highest level and to do everything I can ongoing for you. And even though you're starting with this one transaction, even though you're coming to buy a piece of bubble gum today, I know that if you're going to basically want your sweets, you should come to me often. And my job is to give you the best advice and to suggest things to you and to keep progressing you in your best interest along the continuum. And that attitude changes totally the way you look at relationships. It's a relationship-based strategy instead of a transaction one.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Totally different.
And in a bottom line kind of perspective, if you look at the client as part of your ongoing capital, that will change the attitude as well.
Most people don't realize they impute no value for the asset value of the customer, when in fact, in my book, that has 10 times the value of the equipment, of the location, of everything. That's your real capital. That's your real asset. That's your real opportunity. That's your residual value. That's your money in the bank. But only if you look at it, you treat it, and you approach it that way, Marty.
Okay. Some of the people listening, in fact, maybe everyone listening, would like to hear about how to pick a business. There's some people thinking about starting a business. There's some people thinking about maybe just doing something on the side. Some are thinking about maybe getting an extra profit center in their ongoing business. Can you tell us how to pick that intelligently?
Well, why don't I give you some integrated, why don't I give you an integrated example, maybe an illustrative hypothetical situation that converges a lot of the work that I do for people. People come to me, Marty, on this particular issue with a lot of different intents. First of all, there might be someone who owns a business and that business is downtrending and they want to use their capital or their energy or their passion and diversify. People come to me because they want to put members of their family into other enterprises. There are people that come to me who have sold a business and they want to either invest, start, or buy something that will be challenging, lucrative, that will build both residual income and cash flow and build net worth or sellability and be a negotiable commodity. There are people that come to me who are working for others or are out of work and they want to put their resources and capital into enterprises. And I have to deal with all of them on pretty much the same vein. I start with the philosophy of optimization, and I say to them, you've got to realize that the same effort, the same capital, the same time or less can produce far greater immediate residual and net worth value. So why do something that produces a fraction of the yield if you can do something that produces more? And I tell them, you got to look for something that is marketing impactable. You got to look for something that has a high residual value, meaning a lot of repeat potential, so that one effort can produce a lifetime's worth of residual sales and revenue.
What's the marketing impactful? Amplify that a bit. Explain it.
Well, you look at either an existing business or an industry where they market terribly, but that has the capacity, if you market more effectively, that alone will give you enormous leverage value.
Okay. Example?
An example. Companies who have tons of customers, but they never communicate with them, they never offer them special packages or buying opportunities, they never develop programs with them where they're in a capacity to render referrals. They never test anything. Those are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful situations. Companies who spend a lot of money in either running ads that they never test or don't use headlines or don't use good headlines, or mailing letters that they don't test or do the same things, or dispatching a sales force that they don't direct and program and work with to improve their marketing proficiency. Anything that's got assets like that that are not being maximized or optimized is marketing impactful. But you want companies, if you're going to buy a company, you want a company that has velocity in motion. There are things going on now, but they're just grossly underutilizing them, if that makes sense. You're looking for leverage. If it's fully leveraged, you have no advantage in buying it.
Okay.
You want something that's grotesquely under-leveraged. Does that make sense?
Quick example?
Well, an example would be like a company that has a lot of customers, but they never try to program those customers to buy more frequently or to buy a larger unit of sale, or a company that runs ads that are terrible, but they're still making money on them, so that if you can make the ad pull three times better, that's all leverage that goes to your bottom line.
Okay. All right. All right. Go ahead to your next point.
So the point is you got to find a business that has those kind of factors existing. A lot of people try to buy a franchise. I caution people against buying franchises until and unless they are certain the franchisor has a powerful and a proven and an applicable marketing program, because what you're buying when you buy a franchise is normally only an operating system. It doesn't get you customers. It doesn't bring customers back. It doesn't generate cash flow. It just sort of says, if cash flow comes, here's how you can manage it. I tell people before they buy a franchise, they should talk to 50 of the franchisees and ask them how they are generating their customers, how they are regenerating their customers. They should find the competitive generic companies in the same field and call those people up and ask them if they would be willing for a fee to consult with them and tell them, these are independent people that did it, not with the franchise, but on their own, how they did it, how they've built their business from a marketing context more than an operational one. Because you can have the greatest operating system in the world, but if you don't have adequate sales, you're going to go broke. If you have lots of sales, you can have the most inept operating system and still make a lot of money. So my key to people is you've got to focus on what's going to generate and continuously sustain the sales and the profits more than just the operating system. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
You want to build a business with two objectives. One, that it can be so systematized that you don't have to be the critical function. And two, it can produce such predictable and sustaining revenue and profit that any time you fatigued of it, it would be eminently sellable to almost anybody at a premium price. Why work your life out for something that has no value at the end when the same or lesser effort could produce more revenue now, but any time in the continuum you got tired, you know you could sell out for hundreds of thousands or millions or tens of millions? So that's got to be your strategy, Marty.
Can you give us a good example and a bad example there? Just for...
Well, a bad example is going into a business that is personal services where you are it and you don't replicate it and you have no leverage. Good example is something where you take a concept, probably a service concept, because service tends to have the highest profit levels, the highest repeat factor, the highest affinity, because you can get very bonded to the customer, where price doesn't become an issue. It's more the quality and the perception of the care and the regard and the protection or the enhancement and the frequency, and you become more a part of the family. I like services which are generically commodities, where you can build services that become proprietary, where you add products or additional services or ways of rendering the service more distinctive and more value perceptive or perceiving than your competitors. But I like service businesses because they have all the components. In other words, I tell this funny story. Years and years ago, I lived in a house on top of a hill with a commanding view of the world. It had a 240-degree view of the ocean. It was really majestic, except underneath me, my neighbors had very, very fertile and very plush trees, and they kept growing up, and I had to get them cut down. And I always do tests. I called tree surgeons, tree trimmers, and they are historically a motley lot of people who are very undependable and very, very erratic. But I'd spend about $2,000 every time I'd cut my neighbor's trees down. So I'd call Company A, and they'd come, and they'd give me a quote, and then I'd have to call them back. They wouldn't follow up on the quote. They would very, very erratically come, and finally they'd do the service, and then I'd pay them, and I'd never hear from them again. Even though they knew that I had trees below me that kept growing every 6 months. So 6 months later, I'd call them, and they'd probably be out of business. So I had to find somebody else, and I'd go through the process, and I probably went through 6 tree trimmers because no one ever called me back. That tree trimmer, if he ever wanted to sell his business, probably couldn't get anything for it because his business was only last transaction. He had no future business. Whereas if he had set me up on a basis and said, Mr. Abraham, you know your trees grow up every 6 months. You're paying me $2,000 every 6 months. Why don't I set you up on a systematic maintenance program, and I'll charge you less because I can depend on it. I don't have to advertise. I don't have to worry about it. And every 6 months I'll come and I'll trim the trees automatically until you tell me to stop. And I'll charge you not $2,000, I'll charge you $1,600 twice a year. And I can even break it into monthly installments so it'll be less painful for you. I would have said yes. And that man would have had me as a lifetime client with a predictable stream of revenue and profit. And anybody would be willing to buy that kind of a business. Does that make sense, Marty?
Yes, it does.
So it's a way of looking at your business and a way of looking at the business as you grow. Why go into a business just to give yourself a job that you, at the end of your work life, if you get tired, you basically fire yourself and you get nothing for it. Why not go into business with the strategy from the beginning that you're going to build a business that has two concurrent factors that you want. Number one, it will evolve to the point it can be managed ongoing with a minimum of ongoing time and effort after you get the systems in place. Number two, anytime you tire of it, you can sell it to anybody you want because it is a predictable, ongoing profit machine, money maker, revenue stream that will be predictable long time in the future, and anybody will pay a premium to own it.
Great strategy.
Well, it's the only strategy you should have. See, anything less, you're cheating yourself, Marty. And most people here in business have cheated themselves. They've given themselves maybe a high-paying job, maybe not even that, but if they stop, no one wants it, they can't sell it, it's got little worth except for maybe a discount for the facilities or the equipment or the, you know, or the raw materials. My strategy is to give yourself more leverage. You want leverage on everything you do. Not just the moment leverage, but future leverage. You deserve three things. You deserve to get the most you can now, the most you can from everything you did in the past, and the most you can in the future, all from the same transaction. That's my philosophy.
Okay. Any other insights on how to select a business?
Yes. The business that you want should be one that you can find great joy in. You can, as I said, marketing to me, marketing and innovation are the two critical ingredients that make people money. Everything else is an expense. If that's the case, you want something that has the most market impact ability, and you want something you can understand. You want something I don't like high-tech businesses because I think they're too competitive, they become obsolete too quickly. I like businesses where competition is generically pretty much similar. There's no distinction, there's no differentiation, there's no marketing dynamism, and there's no understanding of these principles. I like businesses where you can really change the whole face and the impact by changing the way you market and persuade and influence and present and position. I like businesses where you render great value, where you can honestly, easily see the value you render and the improvement or the contribution you make to somebody's life or business, and you can be proud of what you do.
Okay.
And all things being equal, you have the right. This is America. You don't have to go into a laborious, mundane, unfulfilling, wretched, schlocky, purposeless, worthless business that at the end of the line you got nothing out of it, no money, no value, no fulfillment, when the same effort, the same years, the same time, the same human capital could produce all the other things I just said. Why do the former when you can have the latter? Why not have the greatest, why not touch the most people you can? Why not bring the greatest value? Why not get the most profit? Why not get the most gratification? Why not get the most pleasure? Why not impact the most people? And why not build the most net worth? I mean, there's no answer to it other than yes, why not?
Do you walk people, your typical client, through this thinking process? Did you have him or her sort through different businesses? How does that work?
Basically, what I have people do is I give them a criteria. And the criteria is a number of different factors you want to exist. Number one, residual value. Number two, marketing impactability. Number three, you know, manageable and, you know, joyous and qualitative. And you put all these things. And then I tell them to sit down with the Yellow Pages and spend a whole weekend reading every business in the Yellow Pages and seeing whether that business satisfies the criteria. And if they find 10 or 15, I tell them to go out then and visit people in areas that are not competitive. Like, in other words, if you're going to go into business in Los Angeles, go to somebody in San Diego or San Francisco or Colorado or Oregon and say, look, I'm not going to compete against you. I'm never going to compete against you. You're going to be regional or local. I'm never going to be more than that. I'd like to learn why you like this business, what you see in it, what gratification you get, what the opportunities are, what you've learned about it, what do you think the essence of making the business work, and interview people. Invest the time. Most people, Marty, don't invest any amount of time qualitatively performing not only due diligence, but compatibility diligence and compatibility with them, with their interests, with their skills, and with the dynamics and the criteria that I've just said. And I think you owe it to yourself to invest an enormous amount of money, time, and a nominal amount of money in discerning that before you make a promiscuous decision.
Your counsel seems so very practical. I don't know whether to be thrilled or annoyed.
I was talking to somebody last night at a dinner party, and we were making a comment that so many people make all aspects of life so much harder, so much more protracted, so much more impeded, so much more unfulfilling than it has to be. It's actually quite simple. It's actually, I mean, simple. Why do anything that produces a lesser outcome when you can do something that produces more? Why do anything that's not fun when you can do everything that's joyous? Why do things that aren't going to pay off when you can do things that pay off massively? Why do things that aren't going to impact people when you can do things that impact people?
Do you have advice for helping people to find what brings them joy? Maybe that's a dumb question, but I don't think so.
No, no one has ever asked that question in that mode, so if you'll bear with me as I engage the squeaky gears in my brain, I will formulate advice right now. But okay. No one's ever asked me that, but I think that you can't have joy until you have purpose. I think that most people need to find a higher causal purpose, and by that I mean people who are consumed with making money and becoming wealthy and dominating, most of them are very unhappy and most of them don't ever accomplish that. People who redirect their focus to a higher causal purpose, to bringing greater value, and then they direct their efforts towards achieving that, normally accomplish massive amounts of successes. I would suggest to people that to find what brings you happiness, find what gives you the greatest purpose. And the greatest purpose is to bring greater value or greater benefit or greater advantage to people, or to make cause something to happen that is significant. And that something has got to be more important than to cause your bank account to expand, because your bank account won't expand if that's your fixation. Your bank account will explode if your fixation is to bring greater value to, or greater achievement, or greater distinction, or greater purpose, or greater utilization to some aspect of something. I'm being very abstract, but does that make sense to you?
Well, yeah, kind of. It seems, the reason I asked the question was, it seems to me that some of us have like a drive to better ourselves, be happier, make more money, and yet don't seem to have the mechanics of knowing how to generate a business idea from that dissatisfaction.
Well, part of it comes from a complacent, inertia-prone or inertia-induced tendency to believe we deserve nothing more than where we are.
Turn the tape over now as we conclude the program on Side 2.
There's a difference between desire and decision. Most people have desire abstractly that someday they're going to do it. I want to make more money. I want to accomplish more. I want a better job. I want more profit or success. I want a better lifestyle. I want more free time. But that's a desire. It's not a decision. When you decide you're going to have it, you have it, because the decision compels you to take action. The action has to be channeled through the crucible of the right process, and the process has got to be a focused understanding that to get what you want requires you to give. See, it's a very simple but a very, very misunderstood formula. To get what you want, all you have to do is give the marketplace what they want, and they'll give back to you many times over. To get what you want, if you're obsessed with getting what you want and you give nothing, you don't get anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a simple process, but it's one that very few people understand.
Well, it seems to me from your background, you learned that lesson a long time ago and started sorting for other people's needs and wants. Way back when?
Long ago when I started, and particularly when I started advising people, if you were my client, your company, the Marty Company,
okay.
If I were giving you advice, my advice would not really be for your benefit. My advice would be championing and advocating what would be in the best interest of your customer. I would move you out of the quotient and just focus directly and connect direct philosophically and figuratively speaking with your customer. And I would program all my efforts for your company in trying to make you render greater benefit to the customer.
Okay, so in essence, are you telling me to look for a customer I would like to serve?
Well, what I'm saying is, and I think on this concept, the strategy of preeminence that we talked about in one of these calls, I delineated a distinction that most people don't have, and it's that most people fall in love with their company or their product or service instead of falling in love with their customer or prospect.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember
that. Fall in love with your customer. Empathize, respect, understand, examine, question, dig to find ways you can bring greater value, greater benefit, greater advantage to their lives, to their business, to their utilization of the product or service that you render. If you are consumed and obsessed with that instead of consumed and obsessed with making money, you will make more money than you ever dreamed possible. If you're consumed and obsessed with making money, you won't make any money.
Do people express a little surprise that there is not, like when you talk about the Yellow Pages, it kind of makes sense to me that most of the businesses that are going to exist in the very near future are already in the Yellow Pages.
I will, on one of these calls and one of these programs, I will give you, the listener, the subscriber, a 20-minute education on a technique for coming up with ideas. When I do that, you will see that all ideas are new combinations of old things and ways reconstructed in new compositions. So what you want to do when you're looking at the Yellow Pages is say, okay, that may be an industry I want to go into now, but how can I combine hybrids of two or three? I mean, you realize something very important. Maybe I should give you an axiom on life that I teach at my training programs and I teach privately to clients. It's that you make the rules. There's no law that says you have to play the game of business or the game of any industry or any company within an industry the way everybody else does. There's no law whatsoever. You're not going to be arrested. As long as you're ethical, moral, legal, and righteous, and everything but legal is subjective. But there's no rule that says you have to play the game everybody else does, the way everybody else does. You can change the rules. You can play any position you want. You can play any way you want. You can change the dynamics at will. You can call timeouts. You have always had. You currently have, and you always have total control. The fate that you are suffering, whoever's listening to this, has nothing to do whatsoever with the economy. It has nothing to do with foreign intervention. It has nothing to do with government looming, encroaching, bureaucratic, whatever. It has everything to do with you and your understanding and acknowledgement of the control you have. You have total control. You can make the rules. You can play any game. You can change the rules. You can compete on any basis. You can refuse to compete and be somewhere else. You can say, I'm going to compete as a commodity. You guys bang your brains out. I'm going to be a proprietor. I'm going to be above you guys, a full dimension and a whole different channel and a whole different jet stream, and I'm not going to compete. Everyone's going to see me unique and in a niche. You don't have to do what everybody else does. There are no rules that you live by except they got to be legal, and you have all the possibilities and opportunities, and you can change at will. If it doesn't work this way, or it doesn't work to your satisfaction, or it works to your satisfaction, but you want more out of it, or you want more joy out of it, you can change it in a heartbeat. You've always had that right. Most people just never exercise it. It's like saying, oh, I loathe the car I'm driving, but not ever going and buying a new one or getting it fixed. You're your own worst enemy. And the moment you realize that, that can change. That will change when you decide. This desire has nothing to do with accomplishment.
Ooh, that sounds like a good sign. Desire has nothing to do with accomplishment.
It's all decision, Marty, isn't it? I'm going to put you on the spot. How many things do you desire that you've never done? I mean, you want to lose weight, you want to be stronger, you want to have more muscularity, you want to have more wealth, you want a new car, you want a bigger house, there are probably 100 things that you've desired or thought about getting that
right.
You want, but you'll never give yourself until you decide. When you make that decision, then it's a commitment, and it translates to action.
Okay, let me pin you to the wall just a little. You've talked to thousands of clients. Can you give some examples of how people have broken out and started to play the game by their own rules?
Yeah, sure. I had one time a client who was in the software business, and they had a very expensive piece of software that they were having a tough time selling, but the software brought incredible value to companies. They sold software that produced forms for large quantity companies like insurance companies, banks. They would do a lot of forms that they would normally have to print. The software was like $15,000, and they were having trouble selling the software for $15,000. But there was a component piece of hardware that you had to buy from somebody else to use the software, and it was about $25,000. The commission on the $25,000 was, I don't know, like 35%. It was whatever, $7,000-$8,000. And that hardware was utilizable for lots of things. And I went to them and I said, you guys are wrong. Why sell something that's against the grain? Why not give people the software when they buy the hardware and show them the 28 other applications they can use it for so they get the forms for free? And just get yourself a distributorship for the hardware. And they did that and they started making millions of dollars.
Okay, how about another example?
I had a convenience food store that was a chain, a guy who was a petroleum distributor who had convenience food stores. He sold gasoline. This was in Australia. Everyone was selling gas at about the same price. We looked through his operation, and we saw that most people in convenience stores, they bought two items based on commodity prices, milk and bread. Everything else, was they didn't care about price. And we analyzed his numbers, and I showed him that if he lowered his price on gas below market, he would probably triple the amount of customers he would get. If he tripled the amount of customers he would get because they had to go into his convenience store to pay, he would probably massively increase the amount of business he generated from the convenience store, which produced profits that were four or five times per transaction the profits he got from gasoline. And I got him to test it in one facility. And what happened was by lowering his price about 2 cents a gallon or 3 cents a gallon, he tripled his business on gas alone, but he doubled his business on convenience stores and added $900,000 a month in profit, I think, and I may be wrong, maybe it was only $300,000, to his operation.
Even if it's $300,000 instead of $900,000 for no more than it took, that's unbelievable.
But he had enough blind faith to try it. But I showed him I could test it in one facility. If it didn't work, move right back up.
And to explain backwards what you're talking about. You're saying that the way the business transaction occurs, is as long as you're within ethical legal guidelines, figure out another way to do it.
Well, I think a big distinction a lot of people have trouble making is they think they are a widget company or a gadget company or a this or that. I think if you're in business, your goal is to make the largest and the most continuous ethical profit you can, however you can. It may be that your product is nothing more than a lead for some other product or service that you can make 10 times as much. In the case in the software, it may be that your software is a better value-added bundled component so you can sell hardware and give and not be a commodity but be a proprietary. It may be that if you're a petroleum distributor, gas isn't really your profit. It's your lead so you can make tons more profit on bread and milk and Cokes and sandwiches and things like that. It doesn't really matter how you make more profit. All that matters is that you make more profit. And I think a lot of people can't get past the fact that, hey, but I'm a petroleum company, or, hey, I'm a software company. I'm not a, and when you, if you can't get past that, you're limiting and restricting radically and dramatically your aspects or your prospects for maximizing your profit.
Okay, can you maybe apply that just a little to a person who is contemplating starting up, how to be flexible, and can you give us an example maybe of a startup that learned to do this?
Two people came to me. One time, a man came to me who was an out-of-work chef in Colorado, and he had a vision. It was a neat vision. He wanted to do a temporary labor business based on the restaurant trade. In other words, if you're a restaurant, if your chef is sick tonight, or your servers are sick tonight, or your maitre d' or your host or hostess is sick tonight, you're really screwed up. And he wanted a service where that was in place. And he came to me, and he wanted help on how to make it work. And I said, well, the way not to make it work is to just do it conventionally, put an ad in the paper and wait for people to call you. The way to make it work is to go out to everyone, explain to them that in the course of a year, statistically, there's whatever the probability they're going to need to have somebody to make up, to fill in and to help out, and that your job is not necessarily for them to use your service, but for you to be there if they ever need to use the service. So set them up, get them all cleared, set up an account, hoping they never need you, hoping they've got their own backup, but knowing that if they do need you, they're all set up. You've got their billing. You've got them set up. You know the criteria. You've got reference files. You can put together a list of all the most probable people instantly that would fill their particular needs by their type of restaurant, their style, their service, their nuances, and have it ready in the event they ever need it. But it'd be set up that way. No one ever does that. They always say, hey, we have temporary help. If you need temporary help, we're there. I got him to set up something like 1,000 pre-approved clients and basically have all kinds of reference data and people to help them if they ever needed it. And as luck and as probability would happen, almost all of them needed it, and he built a really thriving little business instantly. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes.
It's looking at what no one else looks at. Taking it, again, this concept of service. If I say to you, hey, I've got this service. Do you want to buy it? That's not as powerful as if I say, look, I have a service that might be helpful. You may not need it, but the truth of the matter is if you ever need it and you're not set up, you won't be able to take advantage of it. Let me set you up in case you ever need it. Let's hope you don't need it. If you do need it, I'll have already found 10 or 15 people who are perfect for all these key areas in your business and have them on file. So if you call me with an emergency, I'll know exactly who to call. I want it to go through 10,000 people trying to figure it out, and hopefully you'll never need me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different positioning, isn't it?
Yes. So the key here in terms of dealing with businesses and life as it already exists is to look at it in a manner that no one else has looked at.
That is right. And look at it in a manner based on serving, bringing value, benefiting, contributing more to the other side.
Okay. Talk about the frustrations that you most typically encounter. I think you have a list or a categorization of some of that.
There are probably 30 pretty frequently voiced frustrations that I deal with all the time. Probably the biggest one is people are beleaguered and they're just frustrated like mad because they're relegated to being a commodity by the market and they're forced to compete on price alone. At least that's what they think they have to do.
Yeah, that seems to me to be a preeminent problem this time in history. Has it always been like that?
Well, it probably hasn't been quite as brutal, but I think it's, you know, that's, let me make a clarifying statement. One of the most saddening observations I make of business people in general today are their unwillingness to recognize the change is immutable. Change is going to occur whether you like it or not. Wishing and hoping that it would be like it was in 1986 or 82 or 1970 brings you no advantage. Defiantly refusing to meld or comply or acknowledge the dynamic changes and the competition and all those other factors in the marketplace and acting ostrich-like and burying your head figuratively and continuing to use the old strategy that doesn't work and working it harder, thinking that it's going to work better when it didn't work the first time is delusionary. My whole recommendation is realize that change is either your greatest ally or your most mortal enemy. And it has nothing to do with it. It has everything to do with you and the way you embrace it.
So the way you cope with the
cope
world.
Cope isn't the word. The way you capitalize.
Okay. All right. The way you would capitalize on the action of someone trying to make you into a commodity would be to look at the situation entirely differently.
That's what I would have somebody do. I would look at it and say, look, everyone else is being forced to be a commodity, and they've resigned themselves to the fact that those are the rules they have to play by. You don't. You can be a proprietary. You can refuse to just sell blank. You can make your proposition different. You can add other products or services to the transaction. You can make what you do different. You can make the product not be the real value, but the advice or the assistance or the technical expertise that you bring that would cost them a fortune, but it's free if they buy the product from you. So all of a sudden, you're not competing on the same commodity basis as anybody else, and all of a sudden, you've got the playing field totally to yourself.
Okay, that's pretty plain, but can you give us a couple of concrete examples?
I have a friend who is in the fulfillment business. He works with people who sell all kinds of products by mail, and they ship them all over the country. The fulfillment business is a commodity business where you go to them and everybody is like $2 or $3 or whatever, but they're all pretty much the same. They're cheap price-based. They're not emotionally wedded to the client. They're basically a bunch of impersonal, discompassionate, large or small facilities. My friend approaches it different. My friend approaches it, if you work with him, here's what you get. You get a facility that worries about your product as if it were its own. You get a facility of experts who are paid millions of dollars for the team who collaborate with you to help you devise ways to even make your product sell better. You get a facility where they get the orders out guaranteed every day because they know that if it takes longer, you get hit with a higher degree of refunds or dissatisfaction, and that lowers your profit and lowers your ability to pay them. You get a facility where they are constantly working to find ways to improve the way you do it so they can lower your cost, and you get a whole different attitude. And that positioning makes the $3 not even be relevant because they go through an analysis of what it costs you if you use the wrong facility and they take 3 weeks to ship, because bulk rate can take 3 weeks. A lot of people only ship once a week.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, there are studies that show that you get four times the refund rate. Well, it doesn't matter if somebody's 25 cents lower if 25% of the orders come back.
Okay.
And they do. And does that make sense? They position totally different.
Okay, that's why we're listening to you. A lot of us have been ready to settle for the commodity and cowering down. Give us another example.
Okay. I had one time a dental supply company. They sold all kinds of supplies that dentists use in their practice, drill bits and floss and rubber gloves and, stuff that numbs your gums and mouthwashes and, I mean, all the other kind of products and things. And plus or minus a few percentage, everyone's prices were the same. I got them to take a different stance. I said, look, everyone's dealing on a single-issue basis when they sell. You're dealing with products and supplies to the dentist. The truth of the matter is the dentist has a much bigger problem than who to buy his supplies for. He'd much rather buy more supplies if he had more business, more clients, more patients. He'd much rather keep more of the money that he had, meaning operate his business more effectively or pay less taxes. He'd much rather not have to worry about managing a staff that had a high turnover. So, you know, more loyalty, more perseverance, more enduring customers. If you can help that dentist on those issues and produce a profound and a measurable positive impact, they aren't going to mind buying from you. They'd much prefer buying for you, even if it's a little bit more, because you bring so much more value and advantage to their lives. So I set up an operation where if you bought a minimum, and I can't remember, it was like $500 of supplies a month from this business, you got free access to training tapes and programs, and even experts we had on retainer in selling, in marketing, in management, in tax and investment planning, and all kinds of things which brought far more advantage to you than the 2 or 3% difference in savings you might get buying from one to another.
Wow.
That was free. So I changed them from a commodity selling the same product at or around the same price to a company bringing you that who were committed to growing, preserving, expanding your success. And that was free if you bought from them. Does that make sense?
It does. How about just a 40-second other example of this before you go on with your other frustrations?
Well, you know that the competitive bid situation seems like that'd be the ultimate commodity, wouldn't it?
Sure enough.
Well, basically, you got to bid for something, and it's blind, and basically they say, okay, bid on this process. I got a company to refuse to do that. In other words, I said, let's look at the whole, what goes before it, what goes after the process you're bidding on, what goes with it. Find out what those are and add, if there's enough profit in your bid, add that other step free as a bonus for the same price. Just refuse, just because they say, I want you to bid on binding this book. If you say, I'm going to bid on binding it, plus I'm going to bid on throwing in the covers too, and it's the same price, all of a sudden you're proprietary, aren't you?
Well, that's beautiful.
That's basically the way I look at it, Marty.
All right. All right. Talk about some of the other frustrations that you typically see.
Many people are frustrated because they can't get enough new customers or leads. But
right.
The frustration is really based on the fact that they don't understand that they're self-serving. They're saying, I don't get enough people to come to me, instead of saying, how can I bring more value to others? When you change the focus, people will flock around you if you're holding something of value and you can communicate that. Most people don't have anything of value people want. That's why no one comes to them, Marty.
Okay, how do you get something of value?
Well, you redirect your whole focus in asking yourself, what are the benefits? What are the greatest results? What are the advantages? What are the measurable improvements I can bring to somebody? How can I help bring that to them? What promises can I make them? And what interim promises can I give them, and what introductions to that promise can I let them avail themselves of without being at risk on me? And when you answer all those questions, you find instantly massive ways you can offer all kinds of advantages to people that they're going to want to seek out, particularly if they can do it free of risk and free of effort and free of obligation.
Okay, give us an example. Somebody came to you and cried and said, I don't have enough customers.
Well, I would say, okay, why don't you tell me what the greatest advantage you either do or could do for customers. And whatever it is, we would then say, okay, let's figure a way to let that customer know about it, but to do it in a non-threatening, non-obligatory manner. It might be that we offer the customer a booklet, or we offer the customer a little short course, or we offer the customer a videotape, or we offer the customer a free training, or we offer the customer a chance to try it out, or we offer the customer a chance to come to a seminar, or we offer the customer a chance to have us come to them and do a demonstration, but free of risk. And we talk about what the demonstration will produce, and we show the customer the advantage in just doing that to them, not to us, so they see that there is a benefit and a profit to be realized by taking that first step, even if they never go forward.
Okay.
But that's the general process. It's very universal.
All right. Next most common frustration. It's kind of delightful to hear you raise these frustrations then answer them.
Well, most people don't even – they don't have a clear definition of their problem. They're frustrated. I'm frustrated, Marty. And I'll say why. And they most people are not willing to do what I'll call deep-level, penetrating, gripping thinking where they come to resolve and dimensional focus with what the issues in their life and what the opportunities and what the challenges are. Most people don't really know what their frustrations are. They know they're frustrated. And I think going from abstract to specific is the biggest breakthrough bridge you can make towards decision instead of desire. In other words, you're frustrated. Why? I mean, you want a car. Well, why aren't you buying it? Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I want. Well, why don't you figure out what you want? I mean, I don't know if I can afford it. Why don't you figure out what it costs? I don't know. I mean, most people don't allow themselves to get finite. Does that make sense?
Okay, so one of your basic messages, if we could summarize J. Abraham's wisdom, is get finite.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think so.